From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as our new president gets ready to take the oath of office, we ask former President Jimmy Carter to remember his inauguration. Carter has been praised as one of our best ex-presidents. While other former presidents have built their libraries and polished their golf games, Carter travels around the world working for human rights, conflict resolution, and democracy. We'll talk with Jimmy Carter about life before, during, and after his presidency. Also today, book critic John Leonard reviews Bone, a first novel by Chinese-American writer Fei Mayan Nang. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A U.S. Marine has reportedly been killed in Somalia. Wire Service reports quoted a Pentagon official as saying that the Marine was killed in a firefight with Somali gunmen in Mogadishu. The official, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said no identification was immediately available. He said further details are expected from the U.S. military command in Mogadishu. It was the first death of a U.S. service member in Somalia. Marine officials said earlier today that the Marines have been stepping up their efforts to remove weapons from the streets of the capital. They've been stopping and searching cars and cleaning out areas identified as markets for weapons. A New York-based human rights group has sharply condemned Israel for the expulsion of more than 400 Palestinians in mid-December, and a Lebanese army spokesman said Lebanon will no longer allow food into the Palestinian camp. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
An Arabic-speaking researcher from Middle East Watch spent 10 days in the Palestinians' temporary tent camp in South Lebanon. It was the most intensive investigation by an outside organization since Israel expelled the men. The report accused Israel of grave violations of international law. Andrew Whitley, the director of Middle East Watch.
The obligation rests with Israel to maintain these people. They remain in difficult conditions in their camps. The primary obligation to supply them, to maintain them, rests, as I say, with the Israeli authorities.
Whitley said there are no sanitary facilities and the mattresses and blankets are wet from rain and snow. An Israeli government spokesman rejected the report's conclusions. He said Israel is not violating international law because the expulsions are only temporary. He also said the report was biased against Israel. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The oil tanker Breyer, wrecked on a Scottish island, has broken into pieces and spilled close to 24 million gallons of crude oil into the North Sea. But Scottish officials say huge waves appear to be dissipating the oil, minimizing short-term environmental damage, although no one knows what will happen once the weather calms down. NPR's John Nielsen has more.
The Breyer, torn apart by heavy seas overnight, is now a complete wreck. But at a press conference today, local officials reported that a major new spill had not made the present oil slick much bigger. The amount of oil being blown inland also seems to be decreasing, but long-term impacts could still be severe, environmentalists said. Efforts to remove the Breyer from the cliffs may be abandoned. In Sumbra, Scotland, I'm John Nielsen.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 2 points to close at 3,264.6. Advances edged declines in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was about 239 million shares. This is NPR. A leader of the Bosnian Serbs said today that his side would accept an international peace plan for Bosnia-Herzegovina. Radovan Karadzic said told reporters that he would submit the plan to the Bosnian Serb Assembly for approval. Despite the apparent move toward peace, fighting intensified throughout Bosnia today, and another ethnic Serbian leader told British television that the Bosnian Serb Assembly would reject the peace plan. The Supreme Court ruled today that taxpayers may not deduct the expenses of legitimate home offices if the bulk of their work is non-office work done elsewhere. The court's 8-1 decision is expected to affect thousands of Americans who claim home office deductions. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The Internal Revenue Code allows home office deductions only if a taxpayer can show that it is his or her principal place of business. Dr. Nader Solomon thought he could do that since he had no other office. Solomon, an anesthesiologist, spent 30 to 35 hours a week treating patients at Virginia and Maryland hospitals, but he had no office at any of them and used one room in his condominium 10 to 15 hours a week for telephone work, billing, and other paperwork. The IRS said he could not deduct the expenses of his home office from his income at tax time. The lower court said he could. But today the Supreme Court agreed with the IRS. Writing for the court majority, Justice Anthony Kennedy said the test should be not whether the office is legitimate and needed, but its relative importance in the scheme of the doctor's work and the amount of time spent there. Using those criteria, said the court, it is clear that Nader Solomon's main function is treating patients, and it disallowed the home office deduction. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The Pentagon confirmed today that Iraq has operational anti-aircraft missiles deployed in the Allied no-fly zone over northern Iraq. Spokesman Bob Hall said missiles have been moved within the area north of the 36th parallel. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Next week, Bill Clinton will become the first Democratic president since Jimmy Carter. Earlier today, I spoke with Jimmy Carter about his own inauguration, his presidency, and his life since leaving office. Carter has been praised for redefining the meaning and purpose of the ex-presidency by working tirelessly for human rights, conflict resolution, and fair elections around the world, and for improving life in the inner cities at home. First, we talked about his new book, Turning Point, a memoir about his first political campaign back in 1962 when he ran for the Georgia State Senate. Carter decided to enter politics shortly after the Supreme Court issued its one-man, one-vote ruling in the case Baker versus Carr. This decision threw out the county unit system in the South. That system allotted votes by counties with little difference between those with large and small populations. It ensured rural white domination of the electoral process by diluting the influence of black voters and voters in cities. Carter writes he wanted to be part of the new openness and reform in the life of his state and his nation. I asked him why.
Well, I had come home from the Navy, having been 11 years a full-time naval officer, a submarine officer. Started a small business and had never run for elective office. I was a chairman of the Sumter County School Board in the heat of the integration years. I was concerned about the closing down or the subversion of our public school system. And I was disgusted in a way with the slow pace of the civil rights changes in the South. And then along came the bright halcyon days of the one-man, one-vote ruling, where the Democratic white rural primary was going to be stricken down. I thought it was a new day in Georgia and the United States, where the democracy would prevail and honesty would be there and equality would be ensured. And so I decided I would run for the state Senate. And the only request I would make and did finally make was to be on the Education Committee. And I entered this little community over in the western part of Georgia, Georgetown, Georgia, and I found shocking fraud, corruption, stuffing ballot boxes, abuse of citizens, that was incredible to me.
Well, you say you found blatant voting abuse. What's the worst example of voting abuse that you faced during that first campaign of yours?
Well, I was ahead in the election going into this little tiny county on the Chattahoochee River, just across the river from Alabama. There was a political boss in the county named Joe Hurst. He was chairman of the only political organization, the Democratic Committee. He was a state legislator. He was the only state legislator that was authorized by special law to be a full-time state employee. His wife was a welfare director. Georgetown was the only post office in the United States, for instance, where all the welfare checks came to the same post office box. And he and his wife would personally deliver the welfare checks to families that they decided should be on welfare. One of the prerequisites for getting welfare payment was to vote the way Joe Hurst told them. There's no way to ensure that someone votes the way you tell them unless you know how they vote. So a secret ballot was totally out of the question. Everyone who voted in my election in that little town voted on an open table in front of Joe Hurst and one of his henchmen, whose name was Doc Hammond. Joe Hurst watched them vote. They put their ballots in a large whiskey box, a pasteboard box with a 5-inch hole in the top, and quite often I watched Joe Hurst reach in, pull out the ballots, examine them, even change them when he wanted to, and put in ballots of his own. It was literally incredible. And he was so powerful that he was impervious to criticism. He didn't even care if I saw him cheating. He had control of a district attorney. He had control of a trial judge. He had been indicted 8 times on felony charges, convicted 4 times, but never served a day in jail or paid $1 in fine. He was so powerful, it was unbelievable to me. And so I had that to challenge, and many of the people in that little county were intimidated by Hurst. The crucial base of his operation was the county unit system. One vote in Georgetown was equal to 99 votes in Atlanta. And this was all legal. It was perfectly legal until the one-man, one-vote ruling came down.
Well, you say that he was so impervious to criticism, he was so arrogant that even when you caught him in the act of fraud, what he said to you was, well, this is such a simple election that we've decided voting booths aren't necessary.
No, he said, you know, people don't mind if I know how they vote. Why should we have voting booths? There were some voting booths in the courthouse chamber, which he didn't bother to use. He had squeezed people in a little tiny room so that the only place they could vote was on a counter in the ordinary's office, or the probate judge's office, so he and his assistant could watch each vote counted, a cast.
Well, how do you challenge electoral fraud when the people who you have to take the challenge to are aligned with the same people responsible for the fraud?
Well, even with his oppression or inducement of people to vote against me, I would still have won had he not stuffed the ballot box. There were only 333 people who went to the polls that day. There were 421 ballots in the box when they were counted. 118 of them voted alphabetically down to the last letters in their name, a number of whom were dead and or in prison or living in states and way off, and they hadn't voted at all. He was the ultimate appeal in the county, in the entire process, in that role that he played. This was in accordance with the Georgia law. The final decision in any election held in Quitman County, which was Georgetown, was a county seat, was made by the Democratic primary committee that was controlled by Joe Hurst. I finally did win that election, but even then, I had to go to the Georgia Senate. And under the Georgia law, the Georgia Senate has a final determination about who will be seated in that body.
How did you win? How did you get your fair count?
Well, I think a lot of publicity had accrued. I couldn't get any publicity at all at first. The local newspapers, even in Columbus, Georgia, which is a fairly good-sized town, were kind of in bed with Joe Hurst, or they had seen him do this so long that they thought it was maybe acceptable or wasn't really a newsworthy item, until there was one very heroic a reporter from the Atlanta Journal named John Pennington, who came down quite skeptical at first about my allegations. And he, on his own initiative, went into Quitman County, got some old records, interviewed Joe Hurst and all the other people, and found out that my accusations were true. And in a few days, this story about my election was a top headline news on the front page of the Atlanta newspapers. And so I didn't have to operate in a vacuum anymore. And there was no doubt in anybody's mind who read the newspaper or who listened to the news that this was a crime of the first degree in the case of elections.
You know what I found really interesting? Your opponent in that very first election of yours back in 1962, your opponent Homer Moore, ended up supporting you in your presidential campaign. What happened in those intervening years that he became an ally?
He was a good guy. And I don't think he had any knowledge about the ballot box stuffing. This was done in one of the 7 counties by this man, Joe Hurst. Homer Moore was a warehouseman like I was. He was in the peanut business, the fertilizer business, and I had known him for a good while. And so he and I stayed on fairly good terms, even during all the court tests, and both of us wanted to win, of course. Later, after I had been governor, and when I ran for president, Homer Moore and his campaign chairman, whose name was Sam Singer, both or went to foreign states, including New Hampshire, and campaigned for me. So, you know, we wound up to be and continue to be friends. And so Joe Hurst eventually went to prison for vote fraud and also for dealing in illegal liquor. And when I finally got to the Georgia Senate, one of the things that I wanted to do, although I'm not a lawyer, was to revise the Georgia election code to correct some of the patent mistakes that had been deliberately maintained over decades or generations in Georgia to permit this kind of thing. And as we were debating the new election code, one of the interesting amendments that was put forward by a state senator from the town of Enigma, Georgia, an interesting name, was that no one in Georgia could vote in a primary election or a general election who had been dead more than 3 years.
And an interesting cutoff point.
Yeah, but there was a very interesting debate about it, too. People maintained that even though, say, a husband died, there was a certain period of time after his death when the wife and children could accurately cast his vote the way he would have voted if he had lived. And so how long after somebody's death do circumstances change so much that you can't really predict how he would have voted? So as a result of all that, the Georgia election code has been revised, and there are honest elections in Georgia. And as I said, the one-man, one-vote rule not only applied to Georgia but to 31 other states. One of the interesting things is that in states like Minnesota or Wisconsin, the early immigrants who came to our country, say from Norway or Sweden or Germany, wherever, they carefully embedded in their state constitutions the preeminence of rural communities. So as Milwaukee and Madison, Wisconsin, and so forth, built up in size, they didn't have equal votes for their citizens as did a small county where the votes were counted by counties and not by people.
If you're just joining us, my guest is our former president, Jimmy Carter, and he's written a new book about his very first political campaign back in 1962, the primary election for the state senate in Georgia. The book is called Turning Point. How did this affect your view of the American political system? Here you are, you know, a young man, you're running for office for the first time. It's incredibly corrupt. So you decided to stay and, you know, try to do what you could to change that system and so on and so on. But still, I mean, your first encounter with it was a pretty rotten one. Did that predispose you to thinking that there was going to be corruption and that you always had to look for corruption every step of the way?
Well, I was just totally shocked. I was so naive. I never had been involved in politics before. I couldn't believe that something like this could happen in a great nation that was based on freedom and honesty and justice and equality. I couldn't believe it. And had I lost that election, which was seemed to be almost certain for a time, I would never have run for office again, probably. Later, though, I saw that with persistence and tenacity and the marshaling of the strong will of people who wanted to have honesty in their communities, that you could prevail. Also, this was a turning point not only in my own life but in the civil rights movement. It was a one-man, one-vote ruling, I think, more than any other single action of a Supreme Court or the Congress combined that really finally brought an end to legal segregation of the races. And out of that, obviously, came my interest in human rights, in civil rights. And now the Carter Center has as one of its major tasks the holding of elections around the world. We've held elections in a number of countries in this hemisphere and in Africa, for instance. And I've never seen, though, any election that was nearly so fraudulent or filled with corruption or dishonesty or cheating as the one in Georgetown, Georgia, when I ran.
I have to say, that's really saying a lot.
I know, it really is.
You've been around the world watching corrupt elections. What about other elections? How about when you were running for governor or for president? Did you see things around you that were perhaps not as overt, not as blatant as what you saw in state senate, but were still pretty disturbing or pretty corrupt?
Well, I hate to say this in a way, but in this last election in our country in 1992, we invited some Latin American representatives to come and witness the way we conduct American elections. They were shocked at the unfairness of the American electoral system. We assume as Americans that our election is okay. The things that go on in the United States in an election, we would not permit under any circumstances to be perpetrated on the people in Panama or Nicaragua or the Dominican Republic or Guyana or Suriname or Zambia.
What are you thinking of?
Well, one thing is you can't run for office in this country for president unless you're rich. You know, in most countries, in Europe and in the rest of those countries, they don't charge people to present their point of view to the public if they want to be the leader of the nation. Those are free. And when I go into, say, Nicaragua to try to end the Contra War by holding an election, I insist that the ruling party, that it was the Sandinistas, have to provide equal access to television and radio by their opponents. And the same way in Zambia last year, or in Guyana last October, or in other countries. Whereas in this country, you know, unless you're Ross Perot and can spend $50 million out of your hip pocket, you cannot become a viable candidate for president unless you've got millions of dollars to buy your right to let the American voters know how you feel on the major issues. We don't look upon that as a defect in our system, but it's something that would not be acceptable at all in any other country that about which I know.
What else strikes you as being really corrupt in the American campaign system?
Well, I don't say it's corrupt. It's just a fact that we take for granted that wealth or the acquisition of millions of dollars mm-hmm. is a prerequisite to any successful campaign. And I think this has corrupted the Congress in particular. You know, there are legal bribes that greatly influence the decision of Congress on almost any controversial issue. It's the kind of thing, for instance, that Bill Clinton is going to face on health care reform. He's going to have people that own hospitals, and he's going to have medical doctors and others that are making enormous profits on providing health care, who are going to pay Congress members through PAC contributions and speaking engagements with a very high fee and so forth to vote against basic health reform. And this happens in almost every controversial issue that presents itself to the Congress. It's one of the most disturbing things in our government, and it's rapidly increasing as a problem. It's much worse now than 12 years ago when I left the White House.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Jimmy Carter. He's written a new book called Turning Point, A Candidate, A State, and A Nation Come of Age, and it's about his very first campaign, his very first political campaign in 1962 when he was running for state senate in Georgia. We're after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is former President Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, before we go any further, I'm going to ask you for a little lesson in etiquette. Do I call you President Carter, Mr. President, our former President Jimmy Carter? What is the appropriate etiquette when you're talking to a former President of the United States?
You know, one of the nice things about our country is you can call me anything you want to. Jimmy suits me okay. There is a custom in our nation that if you are have been a governor or an ambassador or a judge or president, then you can still retain the title. So if you want to call me President, you can. If you want to call me Jimmy, that's fine. You know, when I go through Georgia, small towns, and somebody is an old friend of mine, I know it immediately when they say, "Hi, Governor." They call this. that's whatever the most intimate relationship is. And the little kids around Plains, when I ride a bicycle or jog by, if they are very devout, or if their families go to church every Sunday, they call me Brother Jimmy. Hello, Brother Jimmy, and a lot of them just call me, hello, Jimmy Carter, but it doesn't matter to me. I never was much dependent on the pomp and ceremony of the White House, even when I was there, and so Jimmy suits me fine.
Now, let me ask you, you've been devoting your post-presidential career to monitoring elections around the world, conflict negotiation around the world, human rights around the world. You also have a project in Atlanta to help empower the homeless and the poor. When you left office, what did you see ahead? What did you think you would do?
I didn't know. You know, I didn't anticipate being retired 4 years early. Fairly quickly, I decided to teach. And I've been a so-called distinguished professor at Emory University now. This is my 11th year. And I've enjoyed that professorship. I make most of my income on my books. All of them have been very good sellers. But when I left the White House, I didn't really know what I had to do except to build a presidential library, which was almost an impossible task for a defeated, you know, Democrat who didn't intend to run for office anymore. And I wanted to write a presidential memoir called Keeping Faith, which I did because I was deeply in debt. And the proceeds from selling off all my business and from the writing of that first book let me pay off my debts. So the evolution of the Carter Center and the different things in which I've been now involved along with Roseland have been really developments that we did not anticipate when we left Washington.
You say that you were in debt. That was in part, I believe, because your peanut factory was kept in a blind trust during your years in the White House, and when
yes.
you came out of the White House, it was over $1 million in the red.
That's right.
So were you very depressed that first year? Here you were. You'd lost the election. You were in debt.
I wouldn't say the first year. Roseland was so much more disturbed by the political defeat and all than I was, that I was strengthened, really, because I had to give her some good reasons why we had a future of hope and gratification. So I had to think of all the good ideas to overcome Rosen's despair. So we worked through that okay. I think I was always more optimistic than she was.
Was there a moment of revelation when it started to occur to you the role that you could take in this nation and in the world as a past president of the United States?
Yeah, in a way there was. I didn't anticipate or understand at all then the tremendous crying out around the world for someone that has been president of the United States to help with issues. Let me just give you one quick example.
Mm-hmm.
At the Carter Center now, we monitor all the conflicts in the world. We do this every day. There are more than 30 major wars on Earth. Almost all of them are civil wars with horrible devastation. Somalia is just a highly publicized one. They're just as bad in Sudan or Mozambique and other places. The problem is that those civil wars cannot be addressed except on the very rare occasions by the United Nations or the U.S. government. It's totally inappropriate for any representative of the U.N. to communicate with a revolutionary group that's trying to overthrow or change a government that's a member of the UN. So most of these civil wars go unaddressed or even unrecognized by the American or industrialized world. And so we go into those areas. I don't have any restraint on me. Because I have been president, I'm famous enough and welcome enough to go to an African nation to meet with the ruling leaders, for instance, and also to meet with the revolutionaries and see if they are tired of war or are convinced that they cannot win on the battlefield, would they agree to let us mediate and try to bring about a ceasefire, at least long enough to orchestrate an election? They may not be willing to sit down in the same room or to acknowledge one another through a direct negotiation. But as you may know, I'm sure you do, the science of politics is self-delusion. Everyone who is running for office, for mayor or for president, whatever, believes that if the election is honest, and if the people know me and know all these other jokers running against me, surely I will win. So if we can convince both sides, or let them convince themselves that they can win if the election's honest, and that I can help guarantee that the election will be honest, they see a way to become president of that nation without continuing the war on the battlefield. So that is a kind of thing that I see very clearly now, which I did not understand at all, even when I was president.
Jimmy Carter's new memoir is called Turning Point. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Jimmy Carter will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Next week, Bill Clinton becomes the first Democratic president since Jimmy Carter. We'll ask Jimmy Carter to remember his own Inauguration Day and the Inauguration Day of his successor, Ronald Reagan. That was the day Iran released the American hostages. It's part two of our interview with the former president. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews Bone, about Chinese-American life, by first-time novelist Fei Mayan Nong. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to top U.S. officials, a U.S. Marine has been shot and killed in Somalia. Officials say the Marine was killed during a clash near the airport at Mogadishu. There are now more than 2,200 U.S. military personnel in Somalia, including those on Navy ships offshore. For a month now, U.S.-led forces have been helping in getting food and medicine to those who need it. The Pentagon says the death of the U.S. Marine is the first U.S. military casualty of the current Western aid effort. In Geneva, at Bosnian peace talks, a Serbian leader changed his mind about a U.N.-sponsored peace plan and said that he would accept it with conditions. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli says that there was a change in mood in Geneva in only a matter of hours.
Dramatic day. By mid-afternoon, it seemed that the entire peace process had collapsed. The Bosnian Serb leader, Radovan Karadzic, had announced this morning that he was rejecting the constitutional principles that had been presented by mediators Cyrus Vance and Lord Owen. They appeared in a press conference, and they were rather grim and appeared very pessimistic about the outcome. A few hours later, there was a complete shift. Radovan Karadzic returned, announced he'd accepted the peace plan on the condition that it be approved by what's called the Bosnian Serb Parliament in Bosnia. This is a self-styled parliament which is not recognized by any international body. So there's going to be a seven-day kind of recess. It's what a conference spokesman called a cliffhanger. We don't know yet the outcome.
NPR's Sylvia Pajoli in Geneva. Meanwhile, in Bosnia, fighting is said to have intensified in certain areas. A new study finds that women who quit smoking can rapidly and dramatically reduce their risk of stroke. David Barron of member station WBUR reports.
Numerous studies have shown that smoking can more than double a person's risk of stroke, and giving up cigarettes can reduce that risk to a normal level. But some reports have suggested it can take as long as 15 years after quitting smoking for the full benefit to appear. A study from the Harvard School of Public Health now finds, at least among women, a smoker's risk of stroke drops to a normal level just 2 to 4 years after quitting. Dr. Ichiro Kawachi says this finding applied to both heavy and light smokers in his study.
Regardless of the age at which they started to smoke and the daily numbers of cigarettes smoked, the benefits were available to all.
The Harvard study was based on health questionnaires sent to 120,000 female nurses. It appears in tomorrow's Journal of the American Medical Association. For National Public Radio, I'm David Barron in Boston.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 2 points to close at 3,264.64 on volume of more than 239 million shares. This is NPR News. According to officials at the White House, Iraq's continued ceasefire violations are a matter of extreme concern. Marlon Fitzwater made this comment as Iraq, for the third day in a row, sent work crews into disputed border areas to get equipment from a naval base. Officials say that Iraq has also been moving anti-aircraft missiles around in no-fly zones in the nation, apparently in an effort to confuse U.S.-led allies on air missions. In New York City at the U.N., Iraq's ambassador said late this afternoon that his country has offered to enter into a dialogue with the U.N. Security Council over issues of concern. Calling Georgia's state flag a symbol of defiance and intolerance, Governor Zell Miller said today that he wants it changed to remove a Confederate symbol. Ed Hula reports.
Speaking to the newly opened session of the state legislature, Governor Miller spent more than a third of his hour-long State of the State message pressing the case for changing the flag, one adopted in 1956 by a General Assembly angry with the early stages of federally mandated integration.
It is clear the flag was changed in 1956 to identify Georgia with the dark side of the Confederacy. That desire to deprive some Americans of their equal rights that are the birthright of all Americans.
Miller's proposal faces an uncertain fate during the next 2 months of the state legislative session. In a recent poll, a majority of the state's legislators said they would vote against changing the flag. For National Public Radio, I'm Ed Hulip in Atlanta.
Court in Germany has ruled that the manslaughter trial against former East German leader Erich Honecker will not take place. Honecker, who is suffering from liver cancer, is expected to leave for Chile, where his family is now living, after officials lift a second charge against him sometime tomorrow. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When Bill Clinton is inaugurated next week, there will be five people able to remember the day they became president of the United States. One of them is my guest. Jimmy Carter is back for the second part of our interview. The occasion is not just the inauguration, it's also the publication of his new memoir, Turning Point, about his first political campaign. I asked Carter about the high points and low points of his inauguration day.
Well, I don't remember any low points that day. The high point, obviously, was assuming the role of a president of the greatest nation on earth and trying to keep a secret we had planned a few days ahead of time to get out of the limousine for the first time in history and walk down Pennsylvania Avenue as just one of a people. And that secret was kept, one of the few secrets, by the way, that we kept while I was president. And it was a glorious reception. The weather was cold. I remember that my mother, who always knew how to take the starch out of people's sails and bring people back down to earth, I was very full of myself. And when we left the reviewing stand and started to walk to the White House for the first time, really, the news media gathered around us. And my press secretary, Jody Powell, said, "Don't anybody talk to the news media. Everybody wants to have an interview." And I complied with Jody's request. But typically, my mother said, "Jody, you can go to hell. I'll talk to whom I choose." And the TV folks and everybody got around, and they said, "Miss Lillian, aren't you proud of your son?" And I waited with great pleasure to hear my mother's response. And Mama said, "Which one?" So she took the wind out of my sails. That's one of the things I remember about Inauguration Day. But it was a glorious day for us, you know, to move in the historic White House mansion and to take on the duties of the president. I just don't have any, you know, negative memories of that day at all.
What was the most disorienting part of your first day and night in the White House?
Well, we didn't know how to deal with the solitude. We were overawed to know that a certain little writing table was actually made by Thomas Jefferson, that he carried around on his horse and wrote, maybe parts of the Declaration of Independence when he was a young person on it, and that this bedroom was used by Abraham Lincoln as an office. You know, the aura of the White House and the humility that you feel occupying the same quarters as those great men was overwhelming. Also, what do you do the next day? You know, I had pretty well gotten my cabinet firmed up quite early after the election, and what do you do the next day to deal with the multitude of issues? I had a very fine agenda. I couldn't get much support originally from the Congress, although finally my batting average was about the same as Lyndon Johnson's or John Kennedy. What do you do when you get in the Oval Office? I hardly knew where it was. I had visited it once before. President Ford invited me in to see the Oval Office after I had won the election. I have to say, though, as a bottom line, that I was quite confident of myself. I wasn't plagued with trepidation that I was inadequate for the job. That may be presumptuous, but anybody who decides I want to be president of this great country has to be somewhat presumptuous. So I wasn't plagued with an inferiority complex. I felt that no matter what came up, that I could handle it as well as anyone.
What about during the hostage crisis? Was there ever a point where you wished that you weren't president, where you wished that you didn't have this terrible burden on your shoulders?
Well, about 2 o'clock in the morning, in April when we tried the rescue operation, and it and we couldn't succeed. That was the perhaps the high point of despair in my presidency. And I knew that I had to get up early the next morning, about 6 o'clock, and prepare to go on all the morning talk shows and explain to the American people that the rescue operation had failed. That was a very dismal point. Also, we knew that an accident had occurred and that one of the helicopters had flown into an airplane and that 8 people had died. And I had to notify those families during the night that their loved ones had perished in a secret operation. There's no way that anything else that happened during the 4 years could equal that as a time of discouragement and despair.
Yeah. You told us a little bit about what your inauguration day was like. Let's skip ahead to the inauguration of your successor, Ronald Reagan. What were you feeling that day as you realized that the hostages were going to be released on his watch, not on yours?
Well, I didn't realize that. I had not been to bed for 3 days and had negotiated in the most meticulous detail the release of the hostages. Everything was all agreed, and the hostages were in the airplane ready to take off at 10 o'clock that morning, Washington time. So we were just waiting to get word that they had cleared Iranian airspace. And when I went to the reviewing stand, when I relinquished the presidency to Reagan and he made his inaugural speech, before I left the reviewing stand, I was informed that the plane had indeed taken off and the hostages were all safe and free. I have to say that I didn't even think about the fact that it happened a few minutes after midnight, after noontime. I just knew that they were free, and that was one of the most glorious and happy moments of my entire life.
Even though it wasn't on your watch?
Well, to me, I didn't even think about it, but obviously that became the major story among the news media, that it happened about 20 minutes after I was no longer president. To me, that was insignificant, but it has still prevailed. Even your question indicates that it was a historically important fact that it happened a few minutes after I left the White House as a president rather than while I was still in office. Well, so I didn't even consider that as a major factor then. It was the news media, I think, that made that a major factor.
One of the reasons why that's historically important is that now there are allegations that the Reagan-Bush team negotiated with the Iranians to hold off release of the hostages until after the election. Do you think that there was a so-called October surprise? Would you like to see any further investigation into it?
I don't really know. I've talked to Gary Sick, who wrote the book and did most of the investigation. He's a very fine scholar and an honest man, and has done meticulous research. Gary Sick is convinced that there was some kind of an agreement made with the Iranians that the hostages would be delayed in release and that enormous supplies of weapons would be made available to the Iranians if I was not any longer the president. I don't know if those allegations are true. I've never tried to find out. I've opened up my presidential library to any researchers who want to come and look at all the past records, but most of those most of the evidence would not be in my files. It would be in the files of President Reagan and his campaign managers. I would doubt, and I've always doubted, that President Reagan knew anything about that kind of an arrangement. It may be that Bill Casey, who later became CIA director and who was President Reagan's campaign manager, did become involved in some negotiations with the Iranians. The evidence seems to indicate that. But as I said, I've never asked for, nor do I now ask for, any sort of further investigation.
Jimmy Carter is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Jimmy Carter is my guest. He's written a new memoir called Turning Point about his first political campaign. It seems to me your reputation has changed a lot since leaving the White House. A lot of people thought you were an ineffective president when you left the White House, but now your reputation, I think, has really risen. People have reconsidered your presidency. Those 4 years are held in higher esteem, and certainly your work since the president, since you left the White House, is held in very high esteem. What does it mean to you to have undergone that kind of reevaluation and come out kind of on the winning end?
Well, I like it. It's gratifying to see the popularity go up and the reassessment of my presidency be made in a favorable fashion. Part of it is kind of inevitable. With the passage of history, people can look back and say, now I understand why this decision was made or what the design was intended to accomplish, or I understand in context that this was beneficial. I didn't see it at the time. The sacrifice that was requested was justified. So I think that's part of it. And the same thing has happened with Eisenhower. The same thing has happened with Harry Truman and with others. So that's part of it. Another one is that the things that I've done since I left the White House have also been favorably reported.
Let me ask you about one controversy you were involved with in your post-presidential years, and that's the BCCI. Some of your groups were funded by the BCCI. What was your reaction when the discovery of the BCCI's kind of corruption and money laundering and so on was revealed? And how did that revelation affect your groups, your funding, your relationship with the head of the BCCI?
Well, I was filled with amazement. I had no idea that BCCI had that kind of character. We had seen in some of the late news reports that a particular BCCI office or bank in Panama had been accused of laundering money, and some of the officials had been indicted and convicted. I never dreamed even then that there was any sort of worldwide allegation of criminality. When we gave up the BCCI financial support for some of the health programs, particularly health, almost exclusively health programs in Africa and in Pakistan, we just had to go out and raise money from other sources.
You say you knew nothing about the BCCI's money laundering and dealing to drug dealers, lending money to drug dealers and so on. Did you feel betrayed when you found out?
Well, I would say disillusioned. You have to remember that BCCI was a special operation that was heavily used by, I understand later, by the CIA and others. It had branch banking operations in 72 different countries. Its main headquarters was in London. It was incorporated, I think, in Switzerland, and was pretty much free of the kind of banking regulations that ordinarily exist in the world. I don't know if the regulations were any worse for BCCI than were for the American Savings and Loan institutions. But anyway, it was a free-wheeling sort of banking operation with which I was never involved. I didn't have anything to do with their banking operations. But if a leader of a nation, had $10 million that he had stolen from the government, his own government, and he wanted to deposit it in a BCCI bank, say in Peru or in some other country, I'm sure they accepted the money. And if he wanted that money transferred to a Swiss bank, I'm sure they did it. Whether American banks do this kind of things, I don't know. I'm not a banker. I don't know much about the banking business. But once the revelation started or the allegations began, it was like a waterfall. And, it just has roared on. But we did use some contributions from the bank owners to carry out health programs. I'm sorry that BCCI was guilty of crimes. We didn't know anything about it, and we obviously stopped getting any sort of BCCI money as soon as we were familiar with it.
One more quick question, looking ahead to next week. What will you be doing on Inauguration Day?
I'll be going up to Washington the night before inauguration. I'll be at the inauguration. When Bill Clinton becomes president, I'll meet my first Democratic president. I've never met one in my life. And then shortly after that, I'll be leaving Washington. I haven't asked anyone yet where I'll be. I presume as a former president, the only Democratic president that survived, I'll probably be on the platform, but I don't even know that yet.
Will you be wishing that it was you being sworn in,
no.
Or will you be glad that you get to leave afterwards?
I'm glad I get to leave afterwards. You know, I was asked not too long ago, what's his biggest surprise going to be? The biggest surprise will be if he anticipates setting priorities on issues and saying, okay, I'll deal with this the first week or two, and then in March I'll turn to this, and next summer to that, and the second term I'll postpone this. He's going to be sadly disillusioned because, you know, what do you put off? The survival of Yeltsin as a leader of Russia or Bosnia or Somalia or the Haitian refugees wanting to pour into our country or trading with China or the North American Free Trade Agreement with Mexico or the erupting war in Liberia. You don't have any way to control the priorities of crises that come before you. And also, it may be that the greatest crisis of his administration is not at all to be anticipated now. I never dreamed, for instance, that there was going to be a revolution in Iran and that the Shah would be overthrown, which was a turning point, you might say, in my own administration. So I think that's the main thing he's going to have to be concerned about. But he's a competent, intelligent young man. He's got 12 years of experience as a governor. He's had the ordeal of campaigning throughout this country for a long period of time. He's learned a lot about this nation in the process. He has a goodwill of the American people. He has the ability to reach out and have harmony and cooperation and teamwork for the first time in a number of years in Washington. And I have confidence that he'll be successful as a president.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Jimmy Carter's new memoir is called Turning Point. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Some sort of deal apparently has been made in Geneva at the peace talks concerning Bosnia-Herzegovina. I say apparently because the news has been shifting quite a bit over the past day or so. Sylvia Pajoli will bring us up to date from Geneva. Ted Clark explores Western military options should there be trouble in the Serbian province Kosovo. And Gerald's reports on U.S. concerns about Iraqi troops crossing the border with Kuwait. David Isay has a story about a folk doctor in Alabama. And a report from a county jail in New Jersey about visitors outside using sign language to talk to the inmates inside. The warden says he wants it stopped.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Fei Maya Ngong is a Chinese-American writer who grew up in San Francisco's Chinatown. Her new first novel, Bone, is about a family in that Chinatown. Ngong says, "I wrote Bone in English, a foreign language, to my great-grandfather because it became a necessary challenge for me to create a home in this language that could be a resting place for my memories of my great-grandfather and for those of his generation." Critic John Leonard has a review of Bone.
Like flute music or a ghost, Maxine Hong Kingston has to haunt the mindscape of any young Chinese-American writer. She made so much angry magic and sneaky art out of the romance of the Golden Mountain and an ancestor culture that threw female children down its wells. What's left for anybody else to be angry and artful about? Amy Tan came along to sentimentalize the same material under bestsellerdom, and that too must be a trial. What do you do with your first novel when you've got a Chinese-American Garcia Marquez looking over one shoulder and a Chinese-American Mary Poppins looking over the other? What you do, if you're as incorruptible as Fei Mayan Ngong, is to tell your own story with your own astonishing grace notes about flea men and gangsters, laundries and sweatshops, jump rope, fox spirits, paper dragons, snake goddesses, and lament songs, about the heavy weight of the immigrant experience and the unbearable lightness of American being. We are told by Leela, who narrates Bone, "I believe in holding still. I believe that the secrets we hold in our hearts are our anchors, that even the unspoken between us is a measure of our every promise to the living and to the dead." Leela is the oldest daughter, the heaviest with responsibilities, stuck in Salmon Alley in San Francisco's Chinatown, Tethered as if footbound to a difficult mother, an impossible stepfather, their Confucian dutifulness, and their terrible perplexity. Nina is the youngest daughter, who flew away, an American bird, an airline stewardess, from San Francisco to New York. Una is the middle daughter, not light enough to take wing, too heavy to save herself when she falls from the roof of the West Ping housing project. We expect that Leela will tell us why Una jumped, but what Leela's really explaining is why, despite all the anger and silence and guilt, she still so much loves her stepfather, Leon, the merchant seaman and junk inventor. Instead of flying, Leon sails away, blaming himself for Una's death. He had promised, but failed, to bury the bones of a benefactor back in China. Bones have many meanings in this novel. Ancestor bones, lost when they moved the graveyard. Brown bags of bones from pigeons consumed in front of the television set watching I Love Lucy. The bones of Ma's dismembered Singer sewing machine. The big bones that are the connecting seams for the dresses Ma sews at her machine. The belief of the old-time Chinese that blood comes from mothers and bones from fathers, and you divine a person's fate by weighing his bones. On the other hand, not having any skin means that, like Una, you walk the street feeling too much. And from these bones, incense rises. And through the smoke, we see not only the old stories of newborn daughters whose mouths are stuffed with ashes, of beardless eunuchs and courtesans with 3-inch feet, but a new story, too. All the metaphors fit together like the folding of a fan, ship's engines and washing machines, flying and sailing, fabric and silence, sewing and inventing. With his electric sink, his cookie tin clock, and his intercom hooked up to the cash register, Leon tries to invent himself, made in America instead of China. Whereas Leela, with the help of an extraordinary boyfriend, actually succeeds in inventing herself, out of both cultures, and what she calls the stillness of time hurting, she finds family and adulthood, courage and peace, skin and bones. Then, magically, she sails and she flies.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Bone by Fei Mayan Nong. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy, and Amy Sallet, with Sue Weinstein and Robbie Harris. Naomi Person directed today's show. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Our intern is Stephanie Baum. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Palestinian scholar Walid Khalidi. He's currently a member of the Palestinian-Jordanian delegation to the Middle East peace talks. Also, we talk with Zev Chaffetz, editor of the Jerusalem Report, a news magazine published in Israel. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.